tell you, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
So you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with an old friend, Hilary Doe. Years ago, when I worked with the Global Finance Project, the Roosevelt Institute, she was the national director of the Roosevelt Network, which involved organizing and convening with over many, many thousands of people in over 100 cities and on college campuses. Currently, she's the chief strategy officer of Nation Builder, and she is the founder and president of Scout. We'll talk about these things and obviously talk about the fact that Hillary is based in Detroit and a lot of interesting, I won't call post-election, but election dynamics that might have helped bring things to a conclusion have just transpired as we approach the Thanksgiving holiday. Hillary, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
So let's start with Scout. Where does the name of your organization come from?
Yes. I'm really excited to get to chat with you actually because of Scout. We recently launched, we're starting our work here in Michigan. And the idea of it for the name actually came from the book To Kill a Mockingbird. So I've just, you know, always found inspiration from that book. And there's this amazing quote where Atticus says to Scout, his daughter, simply because we were licked 100 years ago, before we started, is no reason for us not to try to win. And that like Harper Lee quote has always stuck with me as a motivating force, whether when I was at Roosevelt as national director, at the network, like you just mentioned, in all the sort of endeavors since. And then when I was coming to Scout, I was just sort of thinking that sort of has always been motivating for me, that it sort of doesn't matter if you feel like, you know, you were licked 100 years before you started, because the world is what it is. Here we are. And, you know, we have a vision for the future that we have to take big swings at. And I think now all of us can probably agree that the challenges we're up against are, you know, unprecedented. And the people, all of us on this planet at this moment, have to take them on. You know, this generation requires us to take swings. They can't just hold and wait. The last election cycle and sort of the issues of the time, I think, are evidence of that. And so, yeah, I wanted to sort of embody that spirit of going after the big vision and doing the bold thing, sort of irrespective of the circumstance.
So tell me just a little bit in the kind of day-to-day rhythm.
Yeah.
What are you working on? What at Scout?
Yeah.
What is the process
for sure
to realize these visions?
Yeah, so Scout is a policy shop and an incubator that's really designed to take swings at these big challenges, like I was mentioning, and also to name, identify, and sort of point at the structural barriers that are designed to get in the way of solving those problems. So, you know, at Roosevelt, I have a background in think tanks, right? I've had the experience of getting to watch think tanks try to, you know, shape the conversation, shape our legislation, what have you. And a thing that's always, you know, called to me is a desire to create an institution that can help support that effort from sort of a more zoomed out place, doing both the big, bold narrative work and also the kind of, you know, policy ideas that folks can grab and implement as we go. So, you know, I mean, a lot of what we've seen today over the last little bit here in the last couple election cycles is frankly, you know, folks priming fear, priming, you know, the sort of primal emotion that folks are feeling for real reasons. People who are suffering from, you know, really record inequality, feeling reasonable fear that things are changing, and that's, you know, getting primed for them. And the antidote to that, I've always really believed, is not, you know, you can't tackle fear with a policy brief or one, you know, a memo or something. We have to sort of do the work to recapture the public imagination and take on some of these big challenges from really bold places, sit with the community and like think together about the biggest, boldest vision for, you know, solving a problem that we have that they can come up with, and then sort of doing the work to figure out how we could implement that. Not just doing the policy work, but also writing the big narrative arc, the air cover in the media and on billboards that help us sort of ingrain that the possibility of that reality in our brains. We do that kind of policy work, and we also, you know, invest in and help to support social entrepreneurs and organizations that are, you know, trying to take big swings at these problems from what we think are really, you know, future-oriented, interesting, innovative approaches to solving some of our challenges and kind of getting out of this gridlock that we're in today and a lack of ability to achieve some of these big ideas.
Well, I'm as you sit in Detroit, I'm reminded from the Aretha Franklin film, Amazing Grace, which I was a co-producer of, that she starts out by singing a song called Holy, Holy. It's the first song in the film. And she talks about how we all have to come together and we have to believe in each other's dreams. And I think that creating what you might call those collective focal points as a vaccination against fear is a very important, what you might call, dimension of resolve, dimension of the kind of stamina that's required to see some of these things be realized.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, we had a healthy public imagination that I think has been eroded over time over the last few, you know, decades. And I think, you know, you can see the results of that. And again, it's totally reasonable. The challenges we're up against are very scary. You know, like I mentioned, inequality, but also we've seen the strains in our democracy and the need to strengthen our democracy. If your vote doesn't matter anymore, then you don't have agency to create change and like create a future that you want to live in, right? So that's a really scary prospect. You know, climate change, we have to do something now. There's no sort of resting on our laurels. And I think sort of doing the work, I mean, at Roosevelt, I guess I'll just share personally, I had this incredible opportunity to experience folks, young people across the country, having a first taste of real agency, of their, you know, ability to band together with the community, talk about challenges that they were having locally, from, you know, needing a different solution for trash pickup to big, bold ideas like coming up with a way to ensure access to free college for anyone that went, you know, K through 12 in a local public school district. And then when they would, you know, after working with the community, come up with a solution for that and implement it. Whoa, you know, you could just see folks that change their worldview about what was possible, that you didn't, you know, that you could come together and work together and, you know, learn the tools of organizing and come up with a big, you know, idea and implement it and pass it and change the shape of the world around you, right? And I know that sounds perhaps trite, but I think in these times, the more and more we can like demonstrate and enlist folks in that, the better. And it's harder and harder to do in a world where folks are really struggling. And in the context of, you know, a pandemic over the last year, we've seen the strains, the sort of holes in our social safety net, the daily difficulty that it is for a lot of folks, especially, you know, lower income earners who didn't have a choice to stop working. They had to keep going in, or, you know, were essential workers who didn't have a place to put their kids. And so, you know, who really struggled to separate and socially distance, but had to live in big groups, who really, you know, were hit hard by the pandemic. And it's hard to, you know, you can totally imagine why in this last election, lower income earners swung more for Trump than they had in the past. Because you can prime fear and feel like, gosh, this is scary, and you got to hang on to the little that you've got. And I think, you know, the work is to break out of that and sort of help support folks, deliver real results for those folks with bold ideas, not little ticky-tacky things, but really deliver on some of the big promises that have proven to be really, you know, exciting to that base of voters that we've been talking about. You know, folks have brought about the Green New Deal and some of these, you know, big ideas with, you know, funding more expanded universal healthcare. Those things are capturing, you know, the public imagination. We're seeing that happen. So being in that practice all the time and sort of not shying away from it. And also, like I named at the top, naming explicitly the structural barriers that suffocate that public imagination, things at the state level, like we see here, that, you know, prevent you from raising revenue, from raising any money so that you can fund programs, so that you can do good for people. We have a lot of these structural barriers in Michigan, which I'm happy to dig into later on, or, you know, things like gerrymandering. If your districts all look like lollipops, then you're not able to, you know, vote, see results, get somebody in that, you know, you and your community really want, who's going to do work for you. And that kind of degrades your sense of agency and, you know, ability to affect, to build the future around you. So we really need to take those things, you know, head on and do that work.
Right now in the Detroit metropolitan area, what are the things that you would say are the you know, when you talk about climate, or we talk about various things. I just made a 3-part video and a Q&A session for my Young Scholars Conference with Daniel Ellsberg about the need to continue to diminish the stock of nuclear weapons. His book, The Doomsday Machine, talks about a not unfeasible scenario or risk where we could incinerate the upper atmosphere, what they could call inducing a nuclear winter, and 6.5 of the 7 billion people on the planet would perish within a few months. So there are all kinds of big meta pictures like that, like climate change. They're absolutely essential to the survival of the human race, and they come with the difficulty of requiring collective action across borders and across different cultural focal points or coalitions that may not see things in the same philosophical way. But let's zoom in on what's going on in Detroit and Michigan. That you mentioned gerrymandering, but what's the menu right now that you think is at the top of the dance card?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, there are a lot of things that obviously need to be done and a lot of good work that we can do. But when I have been in conversations with folks about some of those, you know, big ideas, some of the things, you know, the exciting stuff, like, you know, recently the Governor Whitmer's administration passed what's functionally a sort of bill to send essential workers to college for free. These kinds of big ideas that I think like touch at, you know, kind of mitigating, chipping away at inequality, chipping away at some of the really, you know, this meeting the urgent needs that folks have, economic needs and otherwise. When I've been in conversation with folks thinking about all the big things that we can do there, it's just the case that some of the sort of structural, what I would call structural inequality, or this kind of stranglehold on public imagination, gets in the way. And so I know I've mentioned that a couple times, but I'll speak in specifics because I think those things end up rising to the top. Like, you have to take them on in order to do some of this other work. So yeah, I mentioned gerrymandering. I think I'm bringing it up because it's a real problem in Michigan. We saw it in the last couple election cycles. You know, in 2018, we were able to elect statewide, you know, the people voted, right, and wanted Democratic leadership. They elected Governor Whitmer. They elected a Democratic Secretary of State in Jocelyn Benson, a Democratic Attorney General. All women, by the way. It was really an awesome time to have recently moved back to Michigan to be able to vote for those folks, from my perspective, but didn't make any headway at the state level in either chamber of the legislature, because those districts are so gerrymandered. And again, in 2020, this cycle, even though Michiganders elected Joe Biden by a margin, you know, pretty hefty margin relative to the last presidential cycle, 150,000 votes, made no movement whatsoever in the state house and weren't able to flip it, even lost a couple seats that they had previously. So you can just kind of see the impact of that and how that, you know, feels to the voter. So it's just critical that we take on gerrymandering so that people have a voice in, you know, building their future. And I bring it up specifically in Michigan because there was an incredible organization that worked hard in 18 to get a ballot initiative passed called Voters Not Politicians. And I really think they can be a model for the country, because this is the case in just tons of states. And as a result, 25 state house or state legislatures are controlled by, Republicans that are of the ALEC variety, basically, you know, who are introducing ALEC bills, you know, which we again can talk about more in state legislatures across the country, sometimes on the same day. And it's really hard to break that up and reflect the will of the voter in such gerrymandered districts. So anyway, Voters Not Politicians got this ballot initiative through. Citizens voted for it with a tremendous margin. It passed. And we have an independent citizens commission now working on redrawing the districts to ungerrymander the state functionally. And that will be the map that we're working against in 22. So this was sort of the last cycle in Michigan to have to deal, you know, work in this sort of gerrymandered way. And it'll be so interesting. Another reason to watch Michigan, like everyone has been, you know, for the past couple of weeks, to sort of see what happens in 22 and follow that model. In a lot of other states, I think it's been a really inspiring process to get to bear witness to. So that's one of the structural, you know, barriers. And like I said, yet another reason for people to look to Michigan as a source of innovation and incredible organizing. But there are many more. And the one that I think has risen to the top for us in this coming year is around the structural barriers to raising revenue. I know it doesn't sound, I'm talking about public imagination, that I mention raising revenue. It's not, you know, the sexiest policy topic. But Michigan, like a lot of other states in this coming year, is going to face a huge budget shortfall, about $3 billion as a result of COVID impact and, you know, the resulting economic impact. And in a world where you can't even talk about taxes, you can't talk about raising taxes because there's been so much work to ingrain in folks this sense that all taxes are, you know, sort of bad taxes. It's, you can't have a conversation about it, basically. You know, legislators are gun shy to even bring it up. You're staring down a possibility of cutting state budgets by a tremendous amount. And $3 billion is no joke. It implies that you have to, you know, cut social programs that were really lifelines to folks throughout the pandemic. And you have to sort of continue the trend in states of truly systemic disinvestment that we've seen here in Michigan. You know, we're already underfunding tons of things. We're seeing a precipitous fall in our, you know, school rankings, for example. And we can't sort of continue that, let alone, you know, cut it by another $3 billion. So we have to really talk about how to raise revenue. And when we're engaging in that topic, it becomes apparent so quickly how hard it is because of the structural barriers that have been put into place that functionally don't let voters say, I want, you know, X to happen, or I'm dreaming of a Y kind of world, because we couldn't pay for it and couldn't raise revenue for it. So I'll give you, you know, some nerdy examples for the folks listening. One that folks might be aware of in Michigan is that we have a flat tax provision in the state constitution. It's a constitutional, you know, flat tax requirement that means for income taxes, everyone has to pay the same rate, 4.25%. So you couldn't introduce a more progressive, graduated, you know, kind of income tax structure without overturning that constitutional provision. So that means that, you know, it might, people in the state, it's talked about as flat, it's talked about as equal, but functionally, as you know, it's regressive. Equal is not, you know, equity in this regard. And the result is that the bottom decile of earners in Michigan pay 10.4% of their household income in taxes, while the top 1% pay 6% of their household income in taxes. It's, you know, completely the opposite of what you want to see, and sort of it means that there's a real limit on how much money you can raise, because you can't change the tax rate without changing it on, you know, everybody, including folks who shouldn't have to pay as much as they are today. So that's one of the big sort of structural barriers that we're starting to talk about. There's a coalition of Michiganders here, the Fair Tax Coalition, that's really working from a policy perspective and an organizing perspective to start having these conversations. Scout's doing a bunch of, you know, issue education and training and engagement to help folks understand, you know, how taxes work, and that equal isn't equitable, and, you know, that how much more revenue we could raise in the billions of dollars to reverse this trend of systemic disinvestment just by, you know, ensuring that folks who are able to, you know, build successful businesses and make lots of money in Michigan on the back of Michigan roads and Michigan workers in this birthplace of innovation, that they pay more taxes as a result that reflect their equitable contribution. And if lower income earners actually can receive a tax cut and still yield those, you know, a couple billion dollars in sort of additional revenue. So I think that's a really critical one to note. And just the other I'll mention is from a structural perspective before we can get into talking about some fun revenue ideas is that Michigan has a Headley Amendment. So the Headley Amendment in Michigan caps annual property tax to inflation, which doesn't seem like that big of a deal, but it also limits state revenue to 9.49% of personal income, which was the ratio of revenue, state revenue to personal income in 1978. I say that to folks and their jaws drop just because it seems so random. It's like such a arbitrary designation, but you know, it was from this taxpayers' revolt era and folks didn't want to have their taxes continue to increase. So it really locks state revenue at this current point. We're way under that point today, frankly. So it's not that we're bumping up against it at all, but it shows you these kind of structural ways in which, you know, we have to kind of, we have to be cognizant of when we're thinking about the possibilities of raising revenue and the real impact of this, which is, you know, sort of the last maybe boring tax thing I'll say today, is that the combination of that Headley Amendment and Prop A means that property taxes can fall dramatically, like the amount of revenue you can raise from can fall dramatically with, you know, changes in the housing market. So for example, after the housing market crash, we saw, of course, a lot fewer property taxes collected because housing prices went down. But then they can't rebound actually either because they can fall with home values but aren't able to recapture revenue from a quickly appreciating or rebounding market. They can only you know, grow at such at a small rate. And so that means that as of 2019, Michigan property tax collection was about 8.5% below 2007 levels when adjusted for inflation. So it's lagging, right? It's like hard to catch up. So all to say, if you zoom out for a second, we've got a situation where you have a $3 billion shortfall in an already underinvested, you know, state that needs arguably more revenue even before COVID. And you have to counter that with really your hands tied behind your back because you can't raise it from, you know, personal income because you can't introduce progressivity until you overturn a constitutional requirement. And you can't raise it from, you know, property taxes because those are limited in how they can grow. So you end up having conversations about regressive solutions in a system that already is regressive, right? Where we're talking about sales tax on services without appropriate credits to counter those, you know, that increased burden for lower income earners. Or you're talking about raising taxes on everybody, which will never go, and you'll functionally end up cutting programs, which is also regressive. So this is the sort of climate we find ourselves in, and confronting those structural barriers and figuring out how to have a conversation about that with the general public that isn't, you know, totally boring or totally over their head, and instead meets them at an emotional level in the same way as, you know, conversations about raising taxes are emotional for folks, I think is really critical. And so, yeah, we're in that work and we're trying to have real conversations about, you know, equity and trying to have real conversations about the way that the system is sort of stacked up against us so that people have more openness and willingness to have conversations about really bold, cool ideas that we can take on, even in this structure that, frankly, nobody else is really talking about.
Let me shift focus for a minute. You had talked at the outset about the role of fear. And what my Danish friend Vincent Hendricks has written a lot about is what we might call info storms. Recent movie, The Social Dilemma, which you might call Fox versus MSNBC. All of these kind of things, it seems like we have a polarized society now. And I don't think just what you might call the defeat of Donald Trump puts everything back on the rails in you know, kumbaya, and everybody's marching together. We have had a lot of structural problems. I mean, Detroit is, what is it, my friend Jerry Heron at Wayne State said, Detroit is like, he quotes this in an article he wrote called The Humiliation of History. He said, Detroit is like the cloud that hangs over the American dream. It's like an early indicator of turbulence, dysfunction, what we call now diseases of despair, inadequate federal response to the transformation of the economy, all of these things. But what seems like the new ingredient in the era of social media is the polarization and the ability to fan the flames of continued distrust, division, or even perpetuation of mythologies that on the face of it look absurd. COVID is a hoax. It's just, how do you operate in the context where what you might call these info storms are erupting all around? What's the strategy in that realm?
Yeah, I agree with you that it's one of the sort of big problems and challenges of our time. I mean, folks have been talking about this kind of phenomena for a long time. And I mean, even when I was, you know, doing some PhD work, one of my professors at the time was studying basically the change in shared information. So when everyone sat down to dinner and at, you know, 5 or 6 o'clock and watched the news, it was, you know, basically the same broadcast for everybody. And then with the introduction of cable news, of course, that changed dramatically. And now with the rise of social media, you know, you can functionally never read anything that doesn't just confirm your beliefs. You know, we all sort of know this to be true now, but the result is that it's much harder to sniff out things that make no sense, you know, sort of truth, the things that seem like they couldn't be true because you have no exposure at all, you know, to the alternative. And that isn't necessarily the fault of the consumer, right? But it's a truth about, you know, the reality that we're living in. And I think there's tons of work that needs to happen there, tons of accountability that we need to take on, you know, from that sort of social media companies need to take on, that we all need to consider in terms of our impact. There's a lot of work to do. But the sort of tack that we've taken, the reason partly for me that state policy is so compelling and interesting in this moment is that you have a chance to know your neighbor. It's really hard to build trust in other humans when you're talking about people who are, you know, thousands of miles away. It's easy to believe misinformation and stories, but we've seen the impact of, you know, folks having to like build together at the community level. You sort of can't ignore, you know, a problem that's hyper-local. And I think hyper-local engagement and organizing can help to counteract some of this, these frames and some of this narrative and fear. You know, problems at the sort of county level or the state level, you can feasibly be in a place digitally or otherwise, show up, have a conversation and build trust. And I think that's what really needs to happen to counter misinformation. Maybe you've seen it. There was a great study in, I believe they published it an original and then an update in the New York Times. Some, you know, it was an academic study where basically post the 16 election, they brought a bunch of different voters together and, you know, had a conversation in 16. And then, you know, really got to know each other. It was less about politics, I think, and more about, you know, sharing their personal story, what they were up against, what their family composition was like, finding commonality in just their humanity. And then after 2020, they kind of followed those folks and saw how they voted and what have you. And I think their votes did change a little bit, but the most impressive result was really that they were much less likely to believe these conspiracy theories and misinformation, much more likely to call it, to seek sources that weren't just confirming their own bias, because they had a point of reference that said, I don't think that's true. You know what I mean? They had a conversation. I don't think that's true. And so figuring out how to kind of scale and replicate that work feels, you know, really critical. I certainly wouldn't say that I have the answers, but it does feel critical. And I, you know, self-identify as a, you know, progressive person. And I know that a lot of organizers in the progressive space have really said something that I resonate with largely, which is like, some of these folks just, I'm not going to work to extend a hand with people that hate me. You know, I've heard that refrain a lot, and I get it. I do. You know, if someone self-identifies as, you know, a white supremacist, is it going to be helpful for you to stick your neck out and worry about trying to bring them into your coalition? Like, I get it. Why would we worry about that? But I think that it's not, that's not really who I'm thinking of when I'm thinking about, you know, trying to see each other's humanity and get out of these misinformation bubbles. I'm thinking about the fact that, like I mentioned, you know, Trump gained support even in, you know, kind of urban areas or blue areas among low-income workers and the poor. I mean, that's not, those folks were the base for, you know, a lot of unions and union organizing. And it's a reflection, I think, in part of not having those ties, not having as many people in those configurations with each other, talking about their lives and issues and, you know, seeing each other's humanity. It's isolation that can drive folks to fear and then, you know, to vote for a candidate who's priming fear and claiming they can stop change. But, you know, stopping change will not help any of us solve our big problems. It won't help those, you know, tackle inequality. It won't have help tackle climate change. And so I think we have this, you know, requirement to think about how we can break up those misinformation bubbles, get people to face others' humanity in some sense. And that doesn't have to mean, you know, pandering or changing our policy agenda. That's the other thing I've heard. You know, we can't race to the center because of a divisive election. I completely agree with that from a policy perspective. I think the real solution is actually coming up with bigger, bolder policy ideas. Again, capture the public imagination, inspire people, give people a thing to vote for that they want, you know, that they really can believe is possible. And that they want to vote for, not, you know, some middling idea that's uninspiring. So I actually think, you know, from a policy perspective, it can be the opposite. But yeah, I mean, some of the results of the work that's been put in to, you know, make as simple as bringing people together in groups, in communities, and having conversations that might have little to do with politics can have a lot of impact in the fight against misinformation, I think.
Let's also talk a little bit about the role of money in politics. I remember being quite taken aback at the time of the bankruptcy of the city of Detroit that they were making it okay to explore cutting back the health and retirement benefits of particularly women who had worked in municipal government for 30 to 40 years. It was just a default. And they called it a bankruptcy. But let me tell you why that caused me so much heartburn. When a company is employing people and it runs out of revenue, it can't pay. In the downturn after the great financial crisis, there were lots of things that required cutting back or austerity, but the capacity to raise taxes was there. In other words, it wasn't a necessary default. It was choosing to default, or to use the word default, choosing to cut back the benefits of these people so that others didn't have to pay taxes. And there were all kinds of stories, lots of threats about if you do raise taxes, businesses will get up and move. They've got wings, and then you'll be even worse off. But people like Bob Greenstein, Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, had shown in Maryland and other places that basically when you raise taxes, people just pay the tax. But when I presented that to a working group that was advising Judge Rhodes at the time, one of the politicians said to me, "Rob, you're missing the point. It's not that they won't pay the tax, but then they will start building campaigns to run primary opponents against you, advocating for people who would rescind the tax. So the politicians are not going to put on the tax as though people will just pay it, because they know the real reaction in a world of money politics and having to pay for media and organizing is that their future will be put in jeopardy by supporting it. And so they proceeded to cut the benefits of the these municipal workers, cut their health and their pension benefits from, I can't remember, it was like $19,000 a year down to $12,000 a year. These were not extravagant pensions. So that's a long-winded introduction to a particular project I was involved in Detroit. But what do you do to reinvigorate broad-based faith or hope when wealth and income are so concentrated and play such a large role in the design, enforcement, implementation, marketing, lobbying of our public policy?
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously a big question, and I know a lot of folks are taking it on in different ways, and we probably need all of them and even more. So I think one of the biggest challenges of our time, because it gets directly in the way of people expressing their agency, like you just described. I mean, from a Michigan perspective specifically, because, you know, with Scout, we're starting here. You know, Michigan in 2015 was ranked the worst in the nation for government transparency and accountability related to lobbying disclosures, political financing. There's tons of work to do just at the state level here in that area. And a lot of creative stuff, I think, happening in that area. I mean, we already talked about gerrymandering, so I won't belabor it. But frankly, you know, if you don't have horribly gerrymandered districts, you have more of a credible threat to vote people out. And so money has less of an influence, because it's just as credible, you know, a threat to sort of vote against those moneyed interests. And today it's much less so. So that's not unrelated to this. The other thing that I'd say that, you know, specifically we're trying to name for folks and tackle that I think has been a little bit more obfuscated, especially just folks at the state level, are, you know, the fact that for people think about money in politics in terms of lobbying dollars, that stuff is real and critical. Someone needs to take it on for sure. And there are folks, like I said, that are and we're interested in it also. But also it also shows up in more ways that seem less obvious. So, for example, Michigan. Think about the Michigan legislature. These folks are elected for really short terms. They show up. They don't have any resources for their office. They can't spend time doing research on ideas or writing bills because they just like don't have any help. And that's true in, you know, state capitals across the country. So the result is that, you know, a lot of bills are written by lobbyists, and a lot of bills are written by ALEC-affiliated think tanks that are writing model legislation. And we even see...
Meaning what, the American Legislative Exchange
That's
Council?
Right. Is That's that right. They have affiliates all over. Okay. I mean, they're part of what's called the right-wing troika. And, you know, there's a great book about this actually by a former Roosevelter from the Roosevelt Network, Alex Hertel Fernandez. That writes about the troika of basically ALEC and then the Critical State Policy Network, who people talk about less, and Americans for Prosperity. And basically the reason that those groups work so well together is that ALEC's, you know, writing legislation, State Policy Network is doing sort of big framing messaging narrative stuff. So by the time that a state legislature introduced a right to work bill, SPN, everybody knows what right to work means because SPN has been talking about it, for example. I mean, that's just an example, but to give you a sense. So there's this air cover and narrative understanding in the culture and also, you know, then bills. And so, you know, we see folks basically at legislators who want to do good things really without resource to do them. And then just, you know, the ability to grab these bills off the shelf. And the reason I mentioned them in the context of money and politics is because ALEC is, you know, referred to as a think tank, but I really think it's a think tank in air quotes. I mean, the reason I say that is because the way that they do their work, and again, you can read about this in State Capture and a bunch of other places, is, you know, you can, they really raffle policy writing off to the highest bidder. I'm being a little hyperbolic, but only a little. You know, companies pay to sit on these tables by issue area and then contribute to those money to those tables, and the people that contribute the most money get the influence on what the legislation says. They write bills that they want passed at the state level, and then ALEC introduces them to and makes them available via state level affiliates to legislators that can't, you know, don't really have resource to do their own research. And you'll see, you know, the same bills getting introduced in 14 states in the same day. And if that's not money in politics, you know, I don't know what is, but people, I think, don't hold it as closely as they hold, you know, lobbying. So in Michigan, we've seen Stand Your Ground, Copycat bills, tons of union attacks, preventing union due deductions and PAC contributions from paychecks. Of course, right to work laws get introduced, and you'll see, like I said, the same sort of bills that reflect the same level of legislative plagiarism from a model bill that was provided by ALEC in states all over the country. So you can find the same, you know, sentences written in the same bills in a bunch of different states that all came from, you know, one source that was ALEC, but actually was a company that wrote the bill and paid ALEC to distribute it. So I think those are some of the other ways in which, you know, money in politics really, really rears its head. And providing good counter to that is really critical. It's, again, not a new problem. Lots of progressive organizations have taken swings at this. The EARN Network does good work. CBPP state affiliates are doing good work. But, you know, it can be really hard to take this on. And the angle we're taking from Scout is that, you know, you have to do that. The troika exists for a reason. In order, that's the effectiveness is in the troika. It's not just in writing a piece of a bill. It's actually in writing the policy ideas, of course, and like having bold policy ideas available to folks, not just little ticky-tacky things that seem politically palatable. But it's also in, you know, doing the big narrative framing, working with the incredible organizers on the ground here in Michigan to give them sort of more, you know, firepower, more kind of narrative work that they need, more resources to organize folks around big ideas, and making those easily and readily accessible to folks so that they don't have to default to, you know, grabbing an off-the-shelf ALEC bill that was written by a corporation. So I'm not sure that's a direct answer to your question about how to fix the problem, but it's definitely an element of the problem that I feel like has gone, you know, less well addressed.
I think the first part of what you might call correcting a problem is identifying it. And so this, the portrait you just painted is illuminating and helpful in that regard. Let's talk a little bit about education. I've been doing some work with Pope Francis's team from Argentina called Scuola Sal Parentis. And they're talking about what you might call, you know, when I was in school in the Detroit area, everybody in about ninth grade took what you call civics, eighth or ninth grade. And it was all about the institutions of governance. And it was designed to kind of show you what you might call the plumbing of how the whole thing is put together, hung together. The notion of civics seemed to be abrasive to people who think government is the problem and not the solution. And as a result, that consciousness has deteriorated. Well, some of the people from the Pope's group, Scholas, have emphasized that we need something at the high school level that might be called econo-civics, where we understand the things, including institutions like central banks, banks, internet monopolies, or whatever, how they affect your life. And I guess where I'm going is, I'm curious what you think the role of education is in what you might call shaping the minds and the imagination of the kind of people that Scout seeks to inspire.
I love that you brought that up, because I think, you know, we don't talk about it enough. We often, when we're talking about these things, get into, you know, the tactical. So who can, you know, influence who in this given moment, like the power mapping of the current players. And I do think that these are generational problems that we have to take generational swings at. And that does definitely include education. This is a bit of an aside, but when you were talking earlier about the Detroit bankruptcy, I was thinking about education a lot there too, because as you say, you know, businesses don't leave when you raise taxes in a city. They leave when there aren't, you know, workers that are well educated, or when their workers don't want to live in a city because the public school system isn't seen as very good. And actually, like, those kinds of investments can, you know, drive businesses to a city. So anyway, it's an aside, but I was already kind of thinking about education or education system when you mentioned that earlier. And it's something that we do think about a lot at Scout. So I think I mentioned earlier that one of the ways that we're doing our work is via kind of issue education and trainings and community engagement. And, you know, we're really early stage, so we're just getting started. But in Q1 of 21, part of what we have planned are, you know, kind of this doing this kind of narrative work with folks, kind of helping them understand the history in these trainings of, you know, what's changed over time. I think that's a beautiful place to start in education. So, for example, that things weren't always as they are today, but they are what they are today as a product of changes by people. You know, like this situation that we're in didn't fall from the sky. Government is ourselves, as FDR said, and we've put our, you know, finger, different people over time have put their finger on the scale, and this is the situation, you know, that we find ourselves in. And what that, unpacking that implies for folks, right, is also that it's fully changeable. And you mentioned that as well when you were talking about, you know, thinking about banks in our civic discourse, talking about internet monopolies. You know, you're naming all the different players who are expressing their agency and in so doing shaping the society we're living in and the political reality that we're living in. And I think that makes total sense. One of the sort of dreams I've always had is doing this work at sort of with younger people. I mean, again, my background right at Roosevelt was engaging college students, but I think, yeah, junior high, high school level, being able to kind of walk folks through, yeah, what are the issues that are really affecting you now? What are you concerned about? And then walking through the history of why that is what it is today in a really comprehensive sense, like almost from an ecological perspective. Like, what are all the things in the system that have changed and put their thumbs on the scale such that we are here today? And I think it's empowering. I think doing that unpacking is empowering because it helps you realize it's expressions of agency and, you know, kind of we can be in that together as well. And, you know, even things that aren't directly policy related when we're talking about education with, you know, high school students and even younger students, junior high students, I think it's important to note that it doesn't have to be directly political or civic in nature. What we really want to help folks do is sort of prime the power that they have, help them understand, you know, the power that they have, which, you know, I think all of us have to learn to understand. I certainly did. I remember when I first started as a student at University of Michigan, you know, I grew up in a middle-class household. My parents were both public school teachers. We grew up in downriver from Detroit in Monroe County. And I, you know, had a good life. I mean, I was never wanted for anything. But then I remember when I showed up at University of Michigan, I was really struck by the level of income that some folks had that I just didn't even, you know, ever comprehend really. Like, I had a little bit of shock, I think, at how much money some folks had. I also remember having like a belief that, you know, if you were successful, like the epitome of success was basically that you'd be a doctor, a lawyer, or a teacher. And that was sort of the extent of my possibility. You know, that was sort of as much as I thought, those were the options I thought I had. And I really thought it was for someone else to be, you know, elected to office or run a company or something like that. I just didn't think that was for people like me, whatever that meant. And it was really through doing community work and seeing our collective impact on a place, being able to, you know, be of service to a community and change and tackle some of its big problems, that I had my own personal realization that, whoa, you know what I mean? We're capable of sort of shaping the world around us. It's all just a manifestation of the thing that we want to make together. And so for young people, one thing that I believe is true, and I certainly advocate for, is giving people those experiences, even if they aren't directly tied to, you know, like I said, our civic discourse, like bring a bunch of folks together to build something amazing together, to, you know, erect a structure in a public space. Like that can be enough to help kind of enliven a sense of, you know, real possibility and unlock imagination for folks. The last thing I'll say about that, I guess, is there's a bunch of great work called The Lost Einstein, around the Lost Einstein theory, that there are, you know, just tons of folks that would have perhaps been, you know, the next Einsteins, the great creators, the like inventors, that we need to come up with solutions to these big problems that we're facing as a country, as a globe. And that, you know, we need to do everything we can to try and provide, unlock those folks. And today there are so many reasons why we might be missing out on their brilliance and their genius because of, you know, really striking inequality, because of, you know, sort of money and politics, because of the impediments to being entrepreneurial, because we don't have a super strong social safety net. And yeah, I think that's another kind of element of this, really being with those folks, giving people that experience, but also ensuring that our politics and our society supports their creation, so we can all live in a, you know, world that's better because they were able to, you know, help create it.
So Detroit's a famous place for music. When you talk like you're talking today about your work, you've mentioned Harper Lee's quote from To Kill a Mockingbird, but I'm curious, what music flows through your mind as you're embracing the challenges in your life?
Wow, what a great question. It's a very you question, Rob. I mean, you know, music is definitely part of the reason that Detroit has always felt like home to me, because I think that music has always felt like home. Just the joy and exuberance of, you know, Motown has been a staple, I think, for me throughout my life. And, you know, even the Detroit rock scene, I'm going to plug my dad for a second. My dad, you know, never became a famous musician or anything, but he was in the Detroit rock circuit as a teenager and in his 20s, and had the front man of a band called Haymarket Riot that, yeah, and they were represented by, or I guess opened for the MC5 a lot, New John Sinclair, you know, opened for Bob Seger. You know, we're just like in that world for a beat. And so I've always just really stewed in and like had respect for that moment in time. And, you know, the political activism that was like embedded in a lot of those MC5 songs. And yeah, it's just always been kind of a source of inspiration. And like I said, it always made Detroit really feel like home, even though, you know, as a child, we were sort of at an arm's length. You know, I was looking at it from downriver, but yeah, I think that music has been a powerful part of inspiration for me, and hopefully, you know, for the world when they think about Detroit. You mentioned at the top that Detroit has been on everyone's mind for the last couple weeks, and I think it's wild to reflect on it and realize that in some key ways, Michigan felt like, you know, a bastion, the last bastion of protection for our democracy. And I just want to, you know, plug my city for a second too, my chosen city of Detroit, where I live today with my family. I mean, all eyes were on Michigan for good reason. And I was so moved to watch the incredible organizers here do their work. I just think it's important to name them and call them out so that we can all, you know, kind of hold and celebrate them. And it also speaks to the work that I think we all need to do in cities and states across the country, starting now, because incredible organizations like the Movement Voter Project, the We Make Michigan Coalition, We the People Michigan, they've been organizing on the ground every day on election cycles and off cycle. And they were, you know, ready and showed up. They were, you know, the reason that tons of people showed up outside the TCF Center when a bunch of folks were trying to stop the count and were physically trying to get into the building to stop the count. They facilitated a mile long car caravan that surrounded our state capitol, blowing their horns to make their presence known when the Board of Canvassers were taking their vote to certify the election recently. Or the reason, you know, none of this was going to happen under the cover of darkness. 27,000 people showed up to what's normally a pretty perfunctory meeting after each election, which was that Board of Canvassers vote, and gave public comment. We saw, you know, just like real heroes emerge from Detroit. Like I mentioned, I think Summer Woods, who was just a volunteer at the TCF Center while they were counting ballots, and, you know, found herself one human blocking the door, preventing folks from stopping the count. You know what I mean? Like wild stories. And a lot of folks saw Ned Stabler, who's I've known actually for a while since I was in college, who, you know, gave an incredible public comment on the night that Wayne County Board of Canvassers initially refused to certify the election results, and pointed out the hypocrisy and said, you know, you're not willing to certify in Detroit despite a bigger variance in other predominantly white cities. He, you know, named it, didn't let it go unnoticed, named that it was racially motivated or an attempt to disenfranchise millions of voters of color and subvert our democracy. You know, he just, and it went, you know, kind of viral. And I think that those pictures are models really for everyone, for folks in states and cities all over the world to be, you know, organizing and stay prepared, and, you know, just a beautiful kind of examples of incredible work, hard work by a lot of Detroiters in what is a very, you know, hardworking city, and a place that I think we can all learn a lot from.
Well, my own social media friends from Detroit and from my childhood, when I've asked them what songs percolated to the surface, Ball of Confusion by the Temptations. The one that made me laugh was Gil Scott-Heron, We Almost Lost Detroit. And I saw a hilarious Twitter that said that Biden has had to win Michigan so many times that if this keeps up, they're going to change his name to Ohio State. For those who are interested in the old football rivalry and Bo Schembechler, Woody Hayes, and the sure, like. But if I had to pick right now the song that got into my craw as I was listening to you and have been thinking about Detroit in preparation for this, it's by a guy who used to be in a band called the Gories, and then he set up a project which he called the Dirt Bombs. Mick Collins is his name. And he's in a movie, I believe, called Wayne County Rambler, which was quite a lot of fun, that John Sinclair turned me onto. But he's got a song from his album, We Got You Surrounded. It's called Wreck My Flow. Ain't nobody gonna wreck my flow. And I thought the resilience that people demonstrated in Michigan was a breath of that kind of hopefulness that we all needed. We needed people to bar the door. We needed people to stand for the integrity of the process and the system when it was challenged. And while that's not sufficient, that's the seed corn of the kind of hope that I think you've been describing over the course of this hour.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I mean, like you said, it's unfortunate that that's how close we came in the last couple of weeks, but I think that's totally right. And, you know, Detroit and Michigan, it's not going to go down easy. So I think people showed that resilience and persistence. Folks in Detroit know that it's not new for odds to feel stacked against, right? And yeah, just real heroic folks emerged. And I hope that we all take time to celebrate them.
Well, right now, I want to just, with the listeners of this podcast, celebrate you and your work. I want to thank you for being here today, for shedding light on, you know, your deeper sense of purpose. You're an excellent example, and also bringing to bear all of your different thoughts as they pertain to our national and the local situation in Detroit and in Michigan. I hope in a couple of months after we get through the inauguration and we're on our way, I could bring you back on and we can talk about the next phase of things that,
yeah,
how do I say, are necessary to build and which you're working on.
I love that. So great to talk to you.
You too. All right. Thanks. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.